All right, welcome back to Logic Gate, where we are discussing the Star Wars TV show Andor on Disney Plus. I'm your host, Scott, and I'm joined by my two friends, Doug.
Hello.
And Jason.
Hello.
Hello. All right, today we are discussing season one, episode eight, which is entitled Narkeena 5. So before we get started, is there anything we need to recap or talk about from or correct from last week?
You mean like 2 weeks ago? It's been a while.
Whatever. Well, yeah, we took a slight break because Doug got a little sick. So,
yeah, I just want to apologize to the fans for taking a break and missing our tight schedule. Yeah. You know,
we should. Yeah, we can actually talk about that. We actually have one confirmed fan for real now, right?
Yes.
It happens, multiple. It happens to be Jason's dad. So shout out to Mr. Nugent. And Mrs. So, Nugent.
And Mrs. Nugent. Yeah, Nuge.
Mrs. Nuge. Check the description. Be sure to support us on Patreon.
I think that, yeah, they support me quite a bit.
I was going to say, I think your parents do plenty.
Yeah, but they're really into it. They're actually really enjoying the show, and they're following along. And they're like, we watched 8 and 9. Where's the podcast? What's going on? Like, yeah, seriously. So, okay. You know, we're doing it for somebody out there. And
I'm doing it for myself.
Internet land.
All right.
Well, so there was a couple things that I had before we started or whatever.
Go for it.
Other than our fans. So the intro, the Star Wars universe intro thing where this flashes the colors. I don't know if you looked into that a little bit.
I did look at, if you're talking about the B2 MO, he is indeed red in the intro.
Yeah, and so, like, I guess it changes from show to show, but, like, this one, I went through every character. Darth Vader is in red. BB-8 is in blue. C-3PO in blue. Makes sense. Kylo Ren is red. R2-D2, blue. So far, makes sense.
Right.
Rebel. Then there was, like, a Rebel pilot, I think, like a generic helmet. I'm not very good at recognizing them, which was blue. And then it looked like some sort of Imperial Guard, red. And then it looked like a stormtrooper of some sort was blue. It had kind of like that really frowny face with the big eyes. I don't know. That one was off because it was blue, although I assume it's a stormtrooper, which should be red for bad. And then it was B2 EMO in red. So this is probably going nowhere, but that's the research I did there.
That isn't. I literally just watched it while we were discussing.
Yeah. The second one, right before B2 EMO.
Is the only one, yeah.
It's the only one that doesn't follow that bad, good, red, blue thing that I can see. So
interesting. All right,
not interesting, but I have to say it. and there was an interview. I guess I wrote this down. There's an interview with Tony Gilroy about like bad dudes, bad guys, and he was talking about how he was trying to make the villain sort of. Less black and white. Darth Vader was bad because he dressed in black and choked dudes. You know, the Emperor, on the other hand, has had a pale, pasty visage and a creepy laugh. This is a quote from Tony Gilroy. Sure, these folks blew up planets and slaughtered younglings, but that's pantomime villain stuff. In Andor, the villain is the slow, unassuming creep of fascism. That's what I wanted to know. Really, there isn't a villain. There isn't like a villain character. The villain is the overall like creep of fascism, and we talked about that in the last episode. I think that was kind of the theme of like this creeping, sweeping, brutal, chaotic. You know,
the real villain was the friends we made along the way.
I will say, like, this episode has a really dark vibe, and yeah, you certainly get the impression that yes, the beatdown is coming. I mean, clearly Cassian gets kind of beaten day. His spirit gets broken a little bit in this episode. So yeah, for sure.
Yes. The other thing is, I got more. Damn. Okay. So the intro music is different, and I realized looking up the music for it, they released the first two volumes of score. Episode 1 through 8 is volume 1. Episode 5 through 8, or no, 1 through 4 is volume 1. 5 through 8 is volume 2 on like streaming services like Tidal. And every intro so far has been different or slightly different on the same theme. Which
I don't
is
think I've ever even cool. paid attention.
Well, I noticed it on this one because it's, to me, it was very different. It was way more brooding and haunting and kind of dark, more dark than it has been, I thought. More distorted.
Like, on the title screen when they're showing the Andor logo?
Yeah.
Like that?
Yep.
Okay. No, yeah. Kudos to you. That's a great observation. I usually use that as a cue to like go fill up a glass of water or something. Yeah.
I'm loving the music. I've been listening to the soundtrack. So, yeah, and I didn't really know they were all different until this one, but apparently they are all different, and they're putting in a lot of work into the soundtrack. It's Nicholas Britell is doing the soundtrack.
It didn't even occur to me there would be a soundtrack, but no, I'll check it out. Interesting.
Yeah, and there's the dance club, you know, mix. There's a few different versions of that. The Vacation Island dance.
Right.
Yeah. That one is awesome. So, yeah.
All right, anyway, I'll check it out. Anything else you want to get into the episode?
I did want to point out, if I'm recalling correctly, this is now the first episode in the next trilogy, right?
I think it's seven
was a standalone.
Wasn't it going to be two? It was going to be two and then the last three, right?
No, there's three. As far as I'm aware, yeah, there was the standalone seven.
Yeah.
Then there's going to be a three episode arc.
And then two.
And then end with a two episode arc. Yes.
So that sounds like as good a place as any to jump in here. So the episode opens with Cassian being loaded onto a freighter with other prisoners. If you remember from the last episode, he was basically thrown in jail after the judge sentenced him to, 6 years for civil disruption, anti-imperial speech, fleeing the scene of anti-imperial activity, and attempted damage. So he is now incarcerated. So what we see, it jumps around here a little bit. So I'm going to stick with Cassian for a second. We see Cassian get loaded onto a prison ship and it lands, on this, I don't even know how to describe it. It's kind of funky. It was a seven-sided, like island or a building surrounded by water. So there was a bunch of them. So you get the impression this is some sort of like Alcatraz kind of like prison island thing. But it was really interesting. Whatever it was man-made because it was seven-sided. At first I thought it was going to be an octagon because that makes the most sense because you don't see seven-sided things very often. But I had to rewind it and count the sides just because it was kind of unique. So,
I didn't notice that. Yeah. But the prison transport ship, I wouldn't gloss over that because it was like they built a whole set for this prison transport scene where they're like their wrist restraints are like locked in and they tell them to take off their shoes and socks, which I thought, you know, they didn't have to do that scene. It's like a whole but like a, you know, a set for just like a quick, they could have shown the sock and the shoe thing later on. And I love the music in this part in particular. I'm going to come back to the music. It's so cool. Like, it sounds kind of cheap, synthy, like 80s sci-fi, you know? Kind of like Total Recall or Escape from New York a little bit to me.
Okay.
And I think this is really interesting to have a Star Wars property have this type of music where, you know, it's not just sort of the sweeping John Williams, you know, score. I mean, I guess Mandalorian had kind of a Western vibe, like Ennio Morricone, but in general they've stuck with sort of like the same stuff, so I think it's really worth noting.
I haven't even paid attention to the music at all. I really should have. The only new music that stands out to me was like that beach scene when he kind of hits like that techno a little bit, but I'll have to go check out the music.
I love synth stuff and I love 80s like campy, so it evokes a lot of that stuff, so yeah.
So we see Cassian get loaded on a prison ship. The prison ship lands on this seven-sided water base. Cassian gets off of the ship with all the other prisoners, and one of the guards says, "Welcome to Narkeena 5." So Narkeena 5 being the title of the episode, so this is going to be all about whatever this planet, I assume, is. They take the prisoners off of the ship, and they line them all up and they give like this really kind of creepy, intense speech to essentially, you know, let these new prisoners that are coming on board know that the prison guards are the ones that are in charge, because I think there's only, what, 3 prison guards and there's, I don't know, 15 prisoners or 10 prisoners or something. And so they kind of do a little intimidating speech. It definitely had, I want to say, like Nazi-esque vibes, or actually it reminded me of Inglourious Basterds, where the opening scene where I don't even remember what the character's name was in Inglourious Basterds, but he just gives that super creepy speech, and he's not an imposing character, but his speech, like, you just know that this guy is going to be bad news. And that was sort of the vibes I got from these guards as they were reading the riot act to these new prisoners about how life was going to be for them.
Well, yeah, they say your length of stay is predetermined. Your quality of stay is not. And they demonstrate the whole floor setup, right?
So the guards have a special like shock button thing, you know, sort of like you get for your dog, you know, to keep it in your yard. But so they have a button that they can press at any time. And if the prisoners get out of line, it just issues them a very serious, like debilitating shock. And he demonstrates that to the prisoners and basically, you know, takes all the prisoners to their knees or to the ground.
Yeah, this is insane. Like, this is a crazy setup for a prison. It's kind of horrifying, but it's like the technology makes a lot of sense, and they don't even have guns. They don't have, like, there's not even walls really in a lot of places. It's just the floor, and it's a really dark setup for a prison. So yeah,
I kind of appreciate the I say mostly fresh take on, you know, the authoritarian dystopian prison. Like, it's cool, it's a unique perspective on it. The whole like electrified floors, I think it's new. I don't recall seeing that in anything before.
Well, Face Off, if you remember.
Oh wow. That's a throwback.
No, I do not remember Face Off.
It they actually, the prisoners had to wear boots. So it's a slight, very, it's like the opposite, where the prisoners had to wear boots and the boots like stuck to the ground. I don't know if it electrified them, but like it would like make them stay in place. So all the prisoners had boots, but in this, the guards have the protective boots that they, you know, only they have those boots. Everyone else is barefoot and the floor has some sort of electricity that can be turned on in an instant. And like, they demonstrate it in this first scene. They say it's like level one. Just a level demonstration, level one. They look like they're in, you know, agony.
Yeah. Doug, I'm a little disappointed you don't remember the 1997 blockbuster movie Face Off, starring John Travolta and Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, no, I'm disappointed in myself.
Fun fact, Face Off, directed by John Woo.
Yes.
That was fun. We all just have fun.
We sure did.
I think it was originally going to be, it was supposed to be Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone in that one.
Oh, wow.
So, I don't know what would have been better, but yeah.
All right, so at about now, we see Cyril, who is working or doing what he does in the Bureau of Standards, and Miro actually pulls him out, you know, of his cubicle, and she basically tells him, or she starts reading him the riot act, like, "What the heck are you doing? Like, you're." What he's doing is he's retrieving too many records on Cassian Andor, is what she says. Enough so that it trips some sort of alarm or some sort of threshold that got her involved. So she's looking for Cassian Andor. She has no idea who Cyril is. She's like, why are you looking for this guy? This is, you know, what a weird coincidence kind of thing. And so she says that he's been making up stories about Cassian reporting or being part of fuel impurities. Because if you remember, that's what Cyril does for the Bureau of Standards, is deals with fuel and purity levels and things like that. So he's using his job as, you know, the most boring desk job ever to continue his investigation into Cassian.
He's just kind of like like doing inquiries into what he can, like, yes. Like, oh, this is a bad fuel dude. Right. His name is Cassian. What can you give me, like, what information? That's the only thing he is able to do. And so the name Cassian, I think Andor comes up in the ISB's, you right. know, he's talking about this guy that they've been looking for. So, yeah.
So go ahead.
I'll just say, I was actually a little bit disappointed when they started going this direction. I thought Cyril was going to have this cool character arc where, you know, he ends up hitting rock bottom and getting upset with the Empire and then slowly shifting and changing towards the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thought that might be a fun kind of twist for his character. And then in his whole interrogation here by the ISB, like, he just doubles down on the, like, perfect Imperial soldier type. Justice needs to be administered. And it was not the direction I wanted him to go.
Do you think he's doing it for the Empire? I mean, do you think he's just doing it because he wants to, you know, recover the goal? I get the impression, like, this is like a personal mission for him. Like Cassian has ruined his life and forced him to get this job at the ISB. And so, you know, so Cassian is now his white whale, right? Like, he's going to take this guy down for ruining his life. Like, it's personal at this point.
Sure. I don't know. His character just looks like it's becoming a more hardened version of what it was before,
yeah.
Which is not an interesting arc to me.
But it's more realistic, I think. Like, it's kind of hard to believe that this guy who's so into, like, he's so into being like an authority, having, you know, he was so into his job. He like tailored his uniform.
Right.
I mean, yeah. He's just like a law enforcement nerd, sort of. So it doesn't seem very realistic that he suddenly just sort of like, oh, that was a mistake. I'm going to go and do the good guys now.
Look, you're not wrong, but please tell me more about the need for realism in my franchise about space wizards.
I like what Doug's talking about. I think that would have definitely been an interesting character arc if that's what he did. But let's. I mean, there's still time. I don't know. Cyril could get a. He could still jump ship and join the rebellion. So
yep. Yeah, I'm hopeful.
Miro actually, she points out that Cyril is trying to get Blevin's report about what happened on Ferrix. And she's like, well, you were there. Why do you want the report? Like, you know what happened. You signed the report. And he was like, yeah, I signed that report because I was there and they made me, but I never saw the report. I don't know what was officially, you know, put down on paper about what happened on Ferrix. So he's actually trying to figure out like what they said happened on Ferrix. So the scene actually ends with Miro giving him a copy of the report and letting him read this report that he signed so that he is up to speed on at least what the Empire is reporting happened on Ferrix.
Yeah. Only to see if he knows anything that isn't in the report. And it seems like he kind of comes short on that. He doesn't really provide anything other than, you know, it's a gray cloak that the dude was wearing, not just a cloak. So I thought that was kind of funny. He's not really useful. I kind of got this whole thing of, so these people seem like they're kind of a match made in heaven. They're both like really go get them fascist, you know, dudes. But one is clearly way higher up than the other.
Yeah.
And one is trying to get the attention of, you know, her and her superiors and whatnot. In Karn, and then she views him as just like a gnat at this point. Like, you know, he makes the whole speech of like, you know, I was a good officer, and you know, I found this murderer, and trying to like pitch himself. And she says, "Yeah, yeah," you know, pats him on the head. Good job.
Good, yeah, right.
Good boy. Okay, I'm gonna go now. This is a little awkward. I don't know. So maybe they meet up again later, but at this point, it seems like she's done with him. I don't know.
Yeah. It's kind of hot, though, isn't it?
You can tell, like, he has a major crush on her. Like, he wants, yeah.
For sure. Really?
There's a vibe going on.
Oh, yeah. There's,
sure.
there's I a mean, total vibe. He wants.
And they seem right for each other, for sure.
I think she's digging the authority position. Like, she's into it.
She's gonna be in leather with a riding crop by the end of the season. Just wait.
Yeah, that's the realism we need.
All right. So it after that scene, it cuts to back to the ISB round table. They're having a meeting, you know, they're doing whatever, their security briefings. And Miro mentions that she has found Cassian, and she wants to take a massive task force to Ferrix because she thinks he's on Ferrix. And she makes mention of the Axis and how key it is. And I didn't really put two and two together. Do you know what they were talking about the Axis?
Yeah. That's like the code name that they're calling Luthen, because they don't know his name. So they just call
him Axis. Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yeah, she made it like it was a big deal. And I was like, who is that? Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, he's been nimble and spreading his activities across the galaxy.
Right.
But,
I think if I'm not mistaken, she even says something like, he's the axis between all these different incidents of rebel activity.
Yes, right. Hmm. Exactly. So then we see Miro continuing to investigate Cyril after she left Blevins' report with him to read. And Cyril says that the report is missing several key details. And she says, oh, okay, well, tell me, because you were there and I wasn't. She says, what was not in the report? And Cyril mentions the accomplice in a gray cloak, which so clearly they're talking about Luthen. So I think at this point she puts two and two together that's the Axis guy and that he was there. But so clearly in the official report, there was no mention of anyone other than Cassian. So the Empire really only has its eyes on Cassian.
Yeah, I kind of want to go back to that corporate meeting thing.
Okay.
I love everything in the Empire. I've said that before, but I just it feels so realistic where you have like kind of an underling who's trying to kind of going over the top with their reporting. Deirdre is like really fierce and intense with her description. Mm-hmm. And then you have Wolf Yularen, who's the kind of the top dog in this meeting, and he's kind of like in and out of he's barely thinking about it, you can tell, and he's like kind of questioning her, like, why is she so into it? And then Partagaz like backs her up a little bit to help her out.
She's really like leaning into her newfound power, right? I mean, because she kind of got slapped down and slapped down and slapped down, and then in the last episode they gave her, you know, authority over this, and she's really leaning into it. And
she's like really ambitious. And then Wolf Yularen is just kind of like, who are you? And this is going to cost a lot of money to, like, you know, be on Ferrix, you know. And so she's getting a little backup from the mid level dude, Partagaz, you know, who's kind of helped her out and, like, I think probably presented her to Yularen previously. And the dynamics make a lot of sense to me as far as like a corporate environment. Right. I love it. I don't know.
So Miro basically tells Cyril, like, hey, you need to knock off whatever you're doing, looking up stuff on Cassian, because it's raising too many alarms. She said the next time you look into this too much and trip these fail safes, then she says it won't be me you're speaking to. So she's laying out a threat to him, like, hey, I'm on your side. I'm going to let you read this report from Blevin, but this is all you get. This is the end of the road. Do not look into this any further. You know, this is essentially above your pay grade. And then it cuts back to the prison. And so we see at this point the prisoners are now inside of the prison. And I made note that this is the whitest building/room I've ever seen. Like, this room is immaculate. Like, you could do surgery in this room. Like, it's so clean and perfect. And I've seen my fair share of prisons, and prisoners aren't known for being, you know, well kept or cleanly. But clearly, on Narkeena 5, things are spotless. They run this like this is a Swiss watch of a prison, because everything is flawless.
I loved it. I mean, it makes sense for like an empire. Like, this kind of makes sense of what a prison in an empire would look like. They have ultimate control over the prisoners, mm-hmm. like literally every minutia, you know, they And they don't have to like use even physical instruments or barriers or anything. They just have the whole floor electricity stuff. And we learn later it's just a very lethal deterrent to, you know, any sort of obstinance or misbehavior. So like this thing is run like an oiled machine, like
yeah,
really tight, clean, like you said, like it's kind of the ultimate idea of what a, you know, a prison would be in a fascist mind, maybe. I don't
know. Contradictory there, but maybe I'm weird here. I don't see it as a prison. I see this as a manufacturing facility, a right. factory that happens to utilize prison labor. But like the whole electrified floor thing, it honestly, it's like what Amazon warehouses wish they could do to their employees.
Yeah,
exactly. There's a lot of crossover there in prisons and Amazon warehouses, I'm sure.
I agree with Doug. This is a lot less like a prison and more like it is like a manufacturing line. And we'll get into that here in just a little bit. So let's knock this scene out and then we can talk about what they're doing here. So there's a scene. So they're basically bringing these new prisoners in and they're, you know, going to assign them to, you know, I don't know, quarters or whatever. And there's a little scene here about a delayed guard. And he said, I'm sorry, I had to deal with something on floor number 4. And it was really kind of a weird scene. Like it added nothing to the story. I mean, they don't tie back to that at all, but it was just like a little tiny bit of realism that not everything, you know, is flawless, that not everything runs totally smoothly. Like, you know, there are still issues. I just thought that was a little piece of, I don't know, humanity or whatever that they threw into this, that even though they're on this, you know, prison, that, you know, still there are scheduling issues.
Yeah, I mean, there was like 6 guards, and it was really only Cassian, I think, they were processing at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, any one of them could handle him on their own, but like they were waiting for one dude. Like they really needed that 7th dude to like handle him or whatever. It was, yeah, that was funny. I think this was kind of a quick opportunity to show like Cassian kind of observing things and how things are done and like maybe planning. And also it looked kind of like there was a wall of boots in that room, which was just outside of that factory floor. Like they like go right into the factory area after this. So it's very close and there's maybe that'll come up later, but it's kind of an awkward scene.
Did you notice that the boots have the Empire logo on the bottom of them?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
You know, like you would have on the bottom of Air Jordans, you would have the Nike swoosh. It has the Empire logo.
Of course. Yeah. Why not?
So let's see. So they're ingesting Cassian into this prison population, and the guards escort him down to, you know, the floor or whatever. And it's interesting, as Cassian walks in, all the inmates, unprompted, they all put their hands on their head like this is a routine, like there's somebody new on the floor. So and the guards are coming down onto the floor, that they know that just instantly they have to put their hands on their heads, I assume to show that they're not hiding something behind their back or something. And then we're introduced to a new character. His name is Kino Loy, and he's played by Andy Serkis. He played Gollum in Lord of the Rings and a lot of other things. But he's basically the main prison leader. So he is an inmate, but he is kind of the de facto leader, I think, of the floor.
Section. It's level. It's 5-2D. He's the unit manager of that, his particular floor, which apparently like competes against other rooms or whatever.
So basically they drop the Empire drops Cassian off with Kino Loy and leaves essentially. So there's no guards left. And Kino Loy makes mention that the Empire only comes back for the bodies. So there's not a large faction of guards or Empire staff at this prison. They only show up when they need to basically come and do cleanup, that they are on their own. Kino Loy mentions that he has 249 days left on his sentence. So he, again, is definitely a prisoner, but is in charge of all the other prisoners, and the other prisoners defer to him. And he's kind of a hard-ass boss, so he is going around barking orders at the other prisoners. You see they kind of enter into this, I want to say it's like a manufacturing bay or plant, where there are different tables. And the tables in, I don't know how many tables there were in each room. I want to say like 8 probably. So the tables are competing to see who can make the most widgets or whatever it is they're making. And then there are multiple rooms. So the tables are competing with each other. So whoever builds the most gets something nice, and whoever builds the least gets shocked or whatever. And then the rooms compete with each other. So there's kind of like this big, this place is huge, is what I'm getting at, is there are a lot of prisoners here, and they are building something, and there is very much an incentive for the prisoners to build as fast as possible, because there is essentially a competition, competition going. So it sort of looks like, my first thought was that it looked like they were building K2SO units. That was my first thought. But then once the camera pulls back, you can see they're building some sort of like weird hexagonal snowflake looking shape thing. Whatever it is, it's metal, and it takes, I think each table has 7 or 8 guys at it, and they all have to build. I mean, it looks like a car manufacturing assembly line.
I thought maybe it's like TIE fighter parts or something like that. That's kind of where my head went, but
yeah, it's not clear. I definitely, that was one of the notes I left on this episode, is what the heck are they building? Like, I was really expecting it to be something Star Wars related. Like, this is going to be like plates for the Death Star. It's going to be, you know, I don't know, something.
Yeah. Like, that's the thing on the subreddit, though, is like, a lot of people are saying like, it's obviously something with the Death Star. It makes sense for Cassian to be involved, you know, with the Death Star and like being affected by what, you know, the, I mean, it makes a lot of sense for the Empire to use slave labor like this.
Well, considering how big that thing is and how much it must have taken. I mean, right. It's like the pyramids, right? The only way that gets built is if you've got, you know, thousands of laborers. So,
okay, let's just kind of like reflect. Okay, we're watching a Star Wars show, and we're seeing not only just like prisons, like hardcore prisons in a Star Wars, even just a prison, like a realistic prison, but we're seeing slave labor, and we're seeing like torture. We're seeing like the darkest thing that I could really like almost imagine humans doing to each other in a Star Wars show. Like, this is...
Oh, really? I mean, like, don't get me wrong. Like, this is dark, but I mean, if I think, you know, dark prisons, I mean, certainly the concentration camps in World War II were really screwed.
Okay.
Guys are just building car parts, man.
That's true.
Granted, they've got electrified floors, sure, but I mean, otherwise,
they are 100% in control. I mean, yes, you've taught me with the Holocaust prison camp. Yes. I should back up a little bit. This is just incredibly dark Star Wars
property. In the Star Wars universe, this is definitely pretty dark, because Star Wars is a kids show, kids movie. Yeah.
It's almost like Tony Gilroy to me. I kind of like imagine this. He's kind of looking at you know, George Lucas up there writing the original trilogy. Oh, this is an empire. He's like kind of playing with his toys, and he's like, this is an evil empire. And Tony Gilroy's coming along and saying, hey, this is what it, you know, this is what it really looks like here. We're just kind of building we're fleshing out the world you built. We're not making any extra steps. We're just showing kind of what it would really look like.
Yeah.
Like if we filmed the Shawshank Redemption in the Star Wars universe.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Look, they even got the old guy at the table, Brooks.
They do. They totally have a Brooks. You're right. If he had a bird in his coat, it'd be perfect.
Oh, man.
Good call. Maybe that's the next episode.
I didn't think about Shawshank Redemption at all.
I mean, it's...
But it's fair. I
didn't think of Face Off, so, you know, we're even.
Okay.
All right, so next we see Mon Mothma and her husband, and they are toasting at yet another dinner party that they are having. And they are eating these weird gummy worm things that are called Squigs, S-Q-U-I-G-S. And Mon Mothma, the bartender drops one into her husband's drink and goes to put one in Mon Mothma's drink. And she passes, and her husband says, "Oh, I'll have hers." And there's actually a scene later with their daughter, and she says, "Oh, you're drinking squigs again." The implication being that they kind of get you messed up or high or drunk, or I'm not sure exactly, but it was just interesting that it's not something I'd ever seen before, and even their daughter kind of called them on it, like, "What are you doing? That's kind of a weird thing to do." But so from, I think it was the last episode, maybe it was episode 4, Tay Colma comes back, and he makes mention that there are new regulations in the Senate that are making things a lot harder for the rebellion. So clearly, since the heist on Aldani, the Senate is, and Palpatine has new, you know, Patriot Act style powers, things are a lot harder for the rebellion to do what they need to do. Mon Mothma mentions that she's trying to move 400,000 credits, clearly the money from the heist. So she has this money. She needs to get it into the hands of the rebels or do whatever they need with it. Tay Colma is shocked because clearly that's a huge amount of money. So he was just very surprised that, I think that was probably his first look into how serious she is into this rebellion.
Yeah. And I think maybe we're getting hints of like how hard it's becoming to be covert for Mon Mothma. And like, cause I think he says like, you have to explain where some of this is coming from. And she's right. I'm not used to doing that. So I think maybe it's just becoming harder and harder for her to maintain her, you know, status and her current position while doing this. So she's probably going to be coming upon a hard decision, maybe.
Mon Mothma makes mention that she, the implication is that there's other senators at this party and that she is trying to get the votes together that they want to put a check against Palpatine's power. So clearly this is the beginning of Palpatine's rise to power. And so she's still trying to do the political angle and maybe cut him off at the knees. I mean, we have the foresight knowing that it doesn't work, but she's still doing that.
With the Mon Mothma stuff has so far, and not just her, but basically the rebel activity on Coruscant with Luthen as well, it up to this point it's felt intriguing and, you know, kind of clandestine and, you know, mysterious, watching them kind of verbally spar a little bit, you know, back and forth with each other, kind of testing the waters, like, are you friendly, how friendly are you, can I trust you with this secret. It's been intriguing, this scene, and well, frankly, basically all of her stuff in this episode feels more like rebellion budget meetings. It's
well, like, you, I mean, all of her cards are on the table now. Like the last time we met Tay Colma, she was kind of like feeling him out, like, where do you land on the political spectrum? And then like, here we fast forward to this episode and she's like, oh, by the way, I have 400,000 credits that I need moved. And he's like, wait, what? You know?
Yeah. It's lost a little bit of its mystery. I kind of want to see, like, all right, let's get going. Let's take these characters, take this storyline, and get to some action.
I love the political intrigue angle. I hope they do a little bit more with it. I'm with you there.
Yeah, actually, I think we're all in agreement. I think it's yet another dinner party, like highfalutin political dinner party. Like, it seems like they've already done this kind of thing. I don't understand really what these kind of scenes are progressing. They talk about more about like the Empire's directives later in these party scenes, but other than that, yeah, these kind of don't do a lot for me either.
So the scene ends with Mon Mothma looking out the window, and you have this high up view of Coruscant. You see cars flying and you see other buildings. I mean, clearly they're well to do. And one of the guests at the party says something to the effect of, oh, I would just be looking out these windows all day because the view is great. And Mon Mothma's husband says he never looks out the window. So I wrote, like, this guy just lives in an ivory tower. Like, he's got this just great life. He's rich. He's married to a senator. He's got this amazing apartment. And he was just like, ugh, why would I look out the window? That's lame. Like, and then there's just brief mention that Mon Mothma was a senator at age 16. And at age 16, she had already been married for a year. And I don't know why that's important, but I did write it down that, A, that's really young for a senator, and that's extremely young to get married, because it's, I mean, I'm under the impression Mon Mothma is human, and so that seems pretty young for a human to be settling down. But maybe that'll come up later.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know. They there's another party scene where they're talking about the public order resentencing directive, the PORD.
Mm-hmm.
Their conversation about like what powers they want to give the government to combat public safety, which is a fairly relevant and kind of always a conversation that people have. How much security is too much? What are the dangers? But basically, specifically, this directive doubled all prisoner sentences, which is relevant. And we talk about that later. Or the prisoners that we. Cassian's with are wondering, like, are people really talking about this? You know, is this a big news story? So that's
actually a good segue into the next scene, because we cut back to the prisoners and we see Cassian in this line. All the prisoners are lined up and they're progressing somewhere. I got the impression that they're leaving the manufacturing bay and they're heading to probably back to their quarters. So there's a big line. And at one point, Cassian looks out the window and you can just see how big this place is. And he notices that one of the prisoners is looking out the window and he's essentially doing sign language to another prisoner, you know, way across the way, because they can't speak to each other, but they can do sign language. So I don't know if that comes back later, but there was like a little sign language scene there.
Yeah. And I think that was Taga. I think that was Taga, at his table. It's one of the table. But I don't know if that's going to.
So we see after the hallway scene, essentially the prisoners break out into their cells, and some of the prisoners give Cassian, you know, the rundown of here's how the cells work and here's how the floor works. So essentially, in each cell, there's a machine on that gives out food. And the other prisoner that's briefing Cassian mentions that you can have as much food as you want because they want us healthy and strong. So they're not starving the prisoners in here, but the food is kind of terrible and it's bland. It's probably just the basic nutrients that you need to live. And there's mention that the top table, so whichever table, you know, manufactures the most hexagonal widgets or whatever, they actually get to win flavor with their food, and the last place table gets a little electric shock.
Yeah, I thought he said, well, I'm not sure exactly, but he said like the winner gets taste with their food, the top table gets flavor, and then the last place gets fried. So like there's a difference even taste and flavor. Like without any of these prizes, it's kind of like nothing. But then if you win, you get it just even tastes like something.
Yeah. It reminded me like of the tasty wheat scene from The Matrix where they're just eating that.
Oh, just, totally. Yeah.
You know, it's just, yeah. So there is some discussion. Actually, the prisoners are discussing the PORD, the Public Order Resentencing Directive. That you were talking about before, and basically all of the prisoners' sentences were doubled last month. So again, that was in response to the outbreak on Ferrix, that there are new Patriot Act-style powers, and one of the things that the Empire has done is all prisoners had their sentences doubled, and clearly the prisoners are not happy about this.
Yeah, I think that was more in response to the Aldani.
I said the wrong thing. Right. The last thing I noted on this prison scene is there is like an all male, all naked group shower scene, which was kind of interesting. Like it was literally like, I don't even know, like 15 or 20 dudes in a, you know, a room, and just the ceiling is dripping water. So they all just kind of like shower together, which I thought was funny.
I actually thought of, I mean, maybe I'm out of order, but I thought of like gas chamber, like all these.
Oh, dudes, for sure. Yeah. Like, it had that.
It's more like a gas that's sprayed on them to like
a fine mist. Yeah.
It's, yeah, it's really dehumanizing scene.
So the next scene we see Marva, we cut to Marva and, Bix is tending to Marva and Marva got hurt. She was trying to open a gate to, I didn't fully understand exactly what she was trying to do, open a gate somewhere and opening the gate would help the rebellion get access to a different part of the city or something to that effect. And I don't know if somehow she hurt herself on the gate. So Bix and is it Brasso, I think, are having a conversation about, you know, what they're going to do about Marva and how they essentially want to get her off this planet. They want to get her out of this rebellion because she's an older lady and she's going to get herself hurt. Clearly she's already gotten herself hurt, but Marva is having none of it. She's all in for the Empire.
Well, and it seems like her mental state is kind of going in decline, yeah. Like a little bit of, I don't know, dimension or something.
Oh,
like
you think
that.
So?
I don't know. She doesn't seem at her full wits like she was in the beginning of the season.
So we also see that Vel and Cinta are on Ferrix now. So those are the two girls from the heist. And they Cinta makes mention that she's found an apartment to rent or something like that. And I took away from that scene that Cinta wants to rent an apartment and settle down. And like, I'm kind of done being a rebel. Like, this is a lot of work, but Vel mentions, she says it's a battle to the death. And
that's Cinta that says that.
That says which?
The battle to the death. She's the badass. Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. Cinta's all in.
Do I have it? Okay. And then, so she wants to keep rebelling, but, clearly they're not on the same page, I should say. So, yeah.
You know, and it's good representation of, you know, a healthy, same sex relationship.
Well, I mean, any relationship. I just thought it was interesting that they are not agreeing. They did this gigantic heist, and yes, even after all that, like it's not, they're not hardcore. They still have some disagreements.
Well, Cinta is all in, like Doug said. Like she's, you know, gonna die with the cause. But Vel is like thinking, you know, she wants to be with her, and you know, maybe questioning.
Yeah.
Like having to kill people and having to like stake people out forever. And there's a part, Vel asks Cinta, like, who'd you say you were? Like, what's your disguise or whatever? And she says, oh, maybe I'm a rich girl running away from her family, you know, kind of like a jab. Hmm. And Vel says, that's cold. So maybe this is hinting at Vel's background a little bit. Like she's like, Cinta's kind of poking her. Or referencing Vel's maybe family or her background being rich from an important family, maybe.
So I will avoid spoilers, but I will just say that is very definitively answered and addressed in the next episode.
Okay.
Okay. Way to spoil it, Doug.
Yeah, no, I didn't spoil it because I didn't tell you what the reveal was. But
it was a quick thing, but I think... Yeah, it's like...
I have
a
question, though. Mm-hmm. Why are they on Ferrix?
That was my exact thought. Like, of all the places you could have gone, like, why there?
Because they're looking for Cassian.
How do they know anything about Cassian being from Ferrix? Well, How do they know that he's named Cassian?
Luthen knows he was recruited from Ferrix, right? Luthen went there originally. They're working for Luthen to assassinate him. So they know... everything. They know about Bix because Bix is the one that contacted Luthen originally for the trade with the Star Path thingamabob.
The NS9 Star Path unit, yeah.
Yeah. And they probably know the whole thing that went down with Ferrix and where Cassian's apartment is because they you know, the Primos or whatever found his apartment with Marva. And so they're specifically staking that place out. So I don't know. It makes sense.
I'm just thinking if I was involved in like the biggest heist in the Star Wars universe and then like the boss, his next move is, hey, go to this planet where the main perpetual of or guy that participated in this heist is from. And also, yeah. By the way, there's a crapload of Empire people there. Like, I'm going to be like, no, get somebody else.
Yeah, that's true. It does seem like a cold, like, lead, but I guess it's all they have. I mean,
they need, you know, they got to keep the characters involved, so I get it. So
that's unfair. That's unfair. I think it makes sense in the world. Like, this is the only lead they have. This is, you know, this is where they might find more information. Other than this, they have no way to find Cassian. Like they don't know he's in prison. So I don't think it's fair to say, like, oh, they got to keep the characters together. No, this makes sense to me, but...
I'm just thinking if I was Vel and Cinta, I might be like, hey, we just did this massive heist for you. Can I just get like a week, maybe a 2 week downtime just for a little bit before you throw me back into the fire? But
yeah,
strategically, if I was Luthen, I would probably be getting some rando out there somewhere that's not connected to anything to hunt down Cassian. Not like,
right.
Hey, here's another high profile criminal that the Empire is going to be looking for. Why don't you go try and chase him down?
So here's a question, I guess, since we're here about Luthen trying to assassinate Cassian. Do you think it actually is Luthen that knows this is the mission to find Cassian and kill him? Or do you think it's his assistant, like the Clea girl in his shop? Do you think she's more the one that's like trying to kill him? And maybe Luthen, maybe it's just trying to find him.
Well, let's table that for 30 seconds, because that very next thing that happens on the planet is that Cinta basically uses the radio from the beginning that we saw earlier. She basically radios out to, you know, the rebellion, trying to find Cassian to tell him that Marva is hurt and trying to get Cassian basically to come and talk some sense into Marva. And what we see in response is we see Luthen's assistant. So we cut to Luthen's shop, and Luthen and his assistant are having a discussion about this call that just came in. And yeah, like you said, his assistant, whose name is Clea, she is very, I want to say, aggressive. She wants to shut down the radio to Ferrix just because it's too hot. You know, there's too much activity. Like, we can't be tied to this. Like, I got the impression that Luthen was sort of like holding on a little bit. Like, maybe he was slightly hesitant and he wanted to give Cassian a chance to redeem himself or something. I don't know. But it was Clea, who was not quite as close to the heist, so to speak, was trying to distance herself.
Yeah. So she accuses Luthen of slipping, and she's smart because she's right. The ISB is tapping this transmission, and she's smart to shut it down. But I got the feeling that Luthen wasn't totally straightforward with what he was saying. He was just more thought this might have been a good lead.
Yeah,
in the scene. Not necessarily that he wants to help or anything, but I also don't know. Maybe I am just not convinced in Luthen's just immediately wanting to kill Cassian. That seems a little bit harsh after like working so hard to recruit him.
Cassian didn't do anything wrong. I mean, he did the heist exactly like you want. I mean,
I could see him wanting to track him down. He's a loose end. He knows who he is. Sure, says he's worried, but I guess the killing thing may be more on Clea. I don't know. I was curious about your thoughts on that, but.
I got the impression it was more of a Clea call. So we don't know how involved Clea is yet because she's kind of a minor character.
But... Doug, are you being quiet this episode because you know everything?
Actually, I'm not 100% sure, but I think they might recruit Cassian Andor further into the Resistance and have him lead like some sort of rebel assault on an Imperial base that maybe holds plans to the Death Star.
Yeah. Oh. No, there's no way.
That sounds really long and involved. That would have to be a movie, right?
Sorry, did I just spoil everything?
All right. So the next thing that we see, so they Luthen and Clea do agree that this radio communication they have with Ferrix is not a good idea, so they do shut down the radio. So they're going dark. They are distancing themselves from some of these people so that they won't have as much exposure. We see a quick scene at the prison again. It's dark now. Basically, all the prisoners are sleeping. One of the prisoners, whose name is Vimo, basically commits suicide by jumping onto the floor, which is electrified at night because they can't leave their cells. I don't think this really adds a whole lot to the plot, except basically to show that this place is really dangerous and it can actually kill you, not just make you really uncomfortable.
Yeah, and they complain about the smell.
Because they have to smell the corpse, yeah.
Worry about like their next shift because they're down a man. I mean, this is really dark. It doesn't play super dark to me, this is like a really horrifying like situation where they're just like regularly losing people to either like he railed it. They have a term for it, railed it.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're just. So, like, the guards, their main duty is just to, like, pick up, you know, corpses.
Right.
It's dark. Also, wouldn't you think this would require, like, a lot of power running all the time? I was curious, you may be more technical on electrical circuits than I am, but maybe the power isn't, like, necessary until it finds resistance. Is that how it works?
Yeah, it's just like an electrical outlet in your wall, right?
Yeah. I mean,
it's not coursing electricity 24/7. It's just when you plug something in, then it starts consuming. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So to go full sci-fi nerd here, wouldn't they have to be, in order to achieve intergalactic travel, wouldn't they have to be a Type 3 civilization capable of harnessing power from star?
Oh, we're losing our fan base. You're mixing, you're mixing Star Worlds.
Jason's dad just turned the podcast off. He's done.
Oh no!
All right, let's finish this up because there's only like two more scenes left. So, what we see, we cut to Luthen has gone to a new planet that I had not heard of, called Segra Milo, and he actually meets Saul Guerrera. So Saul Guerrera from Rogue One fame. So I thought this was kind of like a little interesting conversation that Luthen and Saul Guerrera has. So Luthen walks in and he basically asks Saul, he said, "Oh man, hey, this Aldani heist is all over the news. Was this you?" You know, so he's trying to, you know, just play up to Saul that, you know, this is the kind of thing that he would have done. And he's trying to give him credit. He's trying to get on his good side. So Luthen has gone with a mission, he's got a plan, and he has some ship parts that he's hoping that Saul Guerrera will want and that they can negotiate on. And Saul Guerrera asks him how much he wants for the parts. And he says, "I'll give them to you for free if you meet someone, if you meet Krieger." And it's not explained who Krieger is. It's, you know, somebody else in the rebellion. Saul Guerrera has a kind of a back and forth with him about, you know, the different people in the rebellion and where their political leanings lie and how serious they are. And I mean, he calls one of them like a neo rebellion. What is he?
Neo Republican.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a separatist. See. And I don't remember the other ones.
But he says, Krieger is a separatist. Maya Pei is a neo Republican. The Gorman Front, the Partisan Alliance, Sectorist, Human Cultist. I mean, they just kind of go back and forth. So the scene basically ends with Saul Guerrera saying, "I don't want to meet with this guy. Like, I'm not, you know, these guys aren't on the same page as I am."
Yeah.
But I thought Luthen had a really good line. He was basically, Saul Guerrera was saying, you know, "I don't want to, if we do too much, then the Empire is going to crack down. They're going to come down harder than they already are." And Luthen says that he wants the Empire to come down hard. He wants them to, you know, essentially issue martial law, because when the rebellion, because it breeds rebellion is what it ends up doing. So when the Empire exerts its iron fist, that's what's going to cause more people to stand up and rebel.
Yeah. This goes back to his other quote. When talking to Mon Mothma, Mothma says, "People will suffer because of this." And he says, "That's the plan."
Yeah.
He wants thing. He wants to ratchet up. He's an accelerationist, basically. And Saw in this scene is kind of playing as the ultimate purity testing anarchist, right? He doesn't want to work with anybody. He says, what does he say? He says, like, I'm the only one with clarity of purpose. And so he's kind of playing as, I mean, this is really cool as far as like a look into a real revolution where you have Luthen, who's kind of, he really is the architect, or he's turning into the architect of this original rebellion. He's willing to like break eggs or crack eggs, so to speak. He's willing to like cause suffering in aim of this rebellion, because he knows that's what it's going to take, I guess. And then you have people that are that want to fight against, you know, the same things, but that you know don't agree with everyone's methods, and ultimately like Saw Gerrera, you know, doesn't. I don't know. I'm curious what happens to him in this series, but ultimately he doesn't really go anywhere. He's not successful with his particular faction, it doesn't seem. But.
Well, I think so. Like you said, like Luthen is prepared for bloodshed. Like he knows that the next step is going to be that people are going to end up dying. So, Saw Gerrera has an interesting line. He says, "I'm a coward. I'm a man who's terrified the Empire's power will grow beyond the point where we can do anything to stop it." And I mean, essentially, that's clearly what happens, right? I mean, they breed Death Stars and huge, you know, fleets of ships. So I think perhaps in this particular sense, Saw Gerrera is a little more of a realist, and Luthen is a little more of an idealist.
It seems like Luthen is really trying to get Saw to come out of his ideologue stuck place. He's saying we need to pull together. You know, aren't you tired of fighting with people who agree with you? Luthen says to Saw, like, just fight with us. Don't just fight against everyone, you know, basically who agrees with you. So I don't know. That's what I took.
This scene to me was interesting for a slightly different reason. And it's the answer to what's next for Luthen. So our first glimmer that we got into his character as a mysterious organizer of rebel activity. Okay, he pulls off the Aldani heist. Great. And then he finishes the episode with, you know, the joy that, like, haha, the rebellion's just started. Cool. Now what? What does he do now? Does he organize another heist? But and the answer that we get here is we see that his next move is to start uniting the rebellion factions. Each one of them has been kind of singularly operating. So now he's trying to work behind the scenes to get them to work together. So he's got the funds to start funding this big operation. So now he's trying to do the political maneuvering to pull them all in. It's just the next evolution of his character. This is the next step. I kind of get the impression that Saw Gerrera was just a cameo, for lack of a better term, to illustrate, like, here's one of the rebel factions. I don't know that he's going to end up playing a bigger role than that, but even so, we see what Luthen's working on now.
That's a really good insight. I did not put that together. I mean, clearly that's what he's trying to do with Saw. I didn't see the bigger picture. That's a very good insight.
Yeah. He's going to give out these weapons as long as you can just meet with this guy, right?
Yeah.
So he's got...
Were they weapons? I thought it was like machine parts or something. It's not important.
Yeah.
Anyway, the scene ends and Saw Gerrera basically says, no sale. Like, I'm not interested. I'm not going to go meet with this guy. He's just... We're not on the same page.
So, yeah, he was trying to get a feel for Luthen. There was like one.
Yeah,
he was trying to ask, like, look into his eyes. But yeah, he wasn't satisfied. They're not. So I think Doug indicating that, you know, he's seen the next episode and he knows it was just a cameo. So we know it's not going to go anywhere.
Okay, I guess we'll see. So the next thing we see is we cut back to Ferrix, and basically the Empire has a warrant for Bix. They are looking to, because they know she has ties to Cassian, and they're looking for Cassian. The Empire shows up, And they actually arrested someone the night before, someone named Paak, P-A-A-K. And so he's well known in the community. I don't know who he is, but so they arrest Bix. Essentially, this is the next day, and they drag her into, you know, whatever, some sort of house that they've converted into an interrogation room. And they've essentially been interrogating and I guess torturing Paak. And he's kind of sitting in this chair slumped over, and he's kind of a broken man because they've been just beating on him essentially. And they're bringing Bix up, and one of the guards offers to, you know, get rid of Paak, and Miro stops and says, no, leave him here, because I want Bix to see him when she comes in. But then when Bix comes in, she kind of like flips and she changes. She's like, oh, I'm so sorry you had to see this, essentially, like, you know, come in and sit down and let's have a conversation. So she's simultaneously playing good cop and bad cop. So she's, you know, she's doing a little psychological warfare on Bix, basically, to let her know, like, hey, you're in our crosshairs. We know you know where Cassian is. Look what I did to this other guy in your town. You better tell me what I need to know. So
just a point of clarity there, Paak is the guy who owned the shop that she was using the radio in the back.
Oh, that, okay. Nope, that makes sense. And then the very last scene before the credits roll is we cut back to the prison, and we see all of the inmates building whatever these weird hexagonal snowflake things are. And then the credits roll. So I thought that was an interesting scene to end on. So they're really hyping up or building up whatever it is happening on Narkeena 5. They're building something, but it's definitely not clear what it is, but that I can only assume that's going to be illuminated in the future. And I think my guess is it's going to be plates for the Death Star. It's going to have something to do with that Death Star. And that's it. Credits roll, episode over. Is there anything else that we want to talk about before we do ratings?
Well, just that torture sequence with Paak and Bix. I think that is the turning point for me, where I do see Daedra as like a villain now because of that. Like, she's we see her interact with the good guys at this point. I think this is the first time we see her interact with characters that we, you know, want to root for, other characters we want to root for. I think Daedra, there's like a part of me that kind of like was rooting for her a while. Like, you know, she's kind of like an underdog in this, you know, environment that she's in. But now she's being like, she's torturing, you know, Cassian's friends, and she's being ruthless about it. And this kind of was a turning point for me. So, yeah.
Doug, you want to rate the episode?
I'd like to go last.
Okay, fair enough. I'll tell you what, I'll go first. I'll break the ice.
Sounds good.
I did not like this episode. And it's not because the episode was poorly written. It's because this episode is really dark. And I'm not going to lie, if the next, how many more episodes we have? 4 episodes are basically just Cassian and or the Rebellion just getting beaten down into submission. It was dark like this, I'm going to have a hard time with it. The writing on this was fantastic. Acting was fantastic. Storytelling was fantastic. Don't have a problem with any of it. It's just the theme. The episode was over and I was like a little bit bummed. Like, I was a little depressed. I was like, oh man, like, you know, I kind of want to watch something that ends on a happy note. Like, so, I, just because I was bummed when the episode was over, I'll give it a 6 out of 10. Also, this is, you know, clearly the start of another trilogy of episodes. This is just set up for the next couple. 6 out of 10. Jason?
Yeah, I think for the same reasons you didn't like it, I liked it. Like, I don't love horror movies. I don't love, like, things that are made with seemingly the sole purpose of being horrifying or miserable. Like, I've talked about this with other shows, like the Bridesmaid Tale, or I always forget.
Handmaid's Tale
or Ozark. It seems like these shows are less about the characters and more about the situations getting darker and darker. I get turned off, but this is a perfect situation for like a horrifying dark element to present itself, because we know Cassian survives. We know where he ends up. But beyond that, this is Star Wars. Like, it's a universe that's really fleshed out. It has a lot of just back elements that we've become accustomed to. So seeing a new angle on it is really, really, I think, fun. It is dark. It really did affect me. Like, this is a really dark episode. But
to be the darkest anything in the Star Wars universe that I've ever seen before, right?
Yeah.
No. I cannot let you just pass up the whole Ewoks playing the drums on the Stormtrooper heads during the Yub Nub song.
Oh my God, come on.
That was dark, man. That was really dark. They ate those Stormtroopers, right?
The Stormtroopers had it coming.
I blocked that out, Doug. That's true. But
I mean, thematically, yeah. Even, you know, when Alderaan gets blown up or, you know, mm-hmm. You see the deaths of all kinds of characters in Star Wars, but none of them are like you said, this dark or this.
Yeah. And so serious. It's not just like murder, right? This is like real ways the Empire can not just like. Force Awakens when they have the ultimate Death Star and they just blast a bunch of planets, which should be dark, right? They should build that up as being a dark thing, but it's like a blip in the movie and it's just played off as evil doers doing evil things. This brings it back to reality. Like it's like, oh, this is what's happening when a massively powerful faction takes over in a really horrifying way. So I appreciate this. I know the greater story that's happening here. I'm okay with the fact that we're seeing this along with these characters. They're really focused on the characters, it seems like. It's not just about the situations. It's about Cassian himself really changing. Like, he's going to eventually work for the Rebels, we know, but we're seeing the project that's happening on him, you know, we're seeing this transition. So I appreciate this. I don't get super bummed out because I know where it's going to go in a small sense. I also asked in a previous episode, like, I want to see more harsh effects of the Empire, remember? I wanted to see them.
Yeah, but didn't you just get done saying you don't like Handmaid's Tale because it's so dark? I mean, that's what you're asking for, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to clarify the difference is.
Yeah, yeah.
Handmaid's Tale is different because it feels like the show is that's the purpose of the show is to present as dark of a situation as possible. Like, they're just trying to come up with new ways of being miserable. Same with Ozark. They're just trying to come up with more like corners that they can paint these characters into. They're not doing any projects on the characters themselves. This show is really it's a project of Cassian. It's going him from a rogue like dude that's just doesn't give a crap about any of the rebellion stuff. He's just trying to survive. Maybe he's trying to find his sister. He gets arrested. He just gets thrown into these things. And so these are things that are developing his character and that are kind of transforming him. Ultimately, we know into more of a rebellion stalwart. So I'm in on this project and I appreciate the dark things that they're going to throw at me because I know it's not just for throwaway, you know, misery. I know that they're creating this element to like, they're trying to provide some sort of like background for the universe that George Lucas really created. He created this fascist empire that's horrific. Like, they're just trying to play this out in a realistic way and present what it really means with this possibility of happening. Like, it's not just this fun, happy, like, oh, bad guys, good guys, right? This is what would happen in this situation. So I really wanted to see the Empire as being super evil. I wanted to understand why the Rebels are fighting so hard. They're sacrificing so much. And this is giving it to me. So this is an amazing episode. I'm going to give it 10 out of 10.
Wow.
Probably multiple episodes I'm going to give that. But
okay.
I really appreciate them going down this road and fleshing out this stuff. It also felt like real sci-fi, like actual, like most Star Wars stuff doesn't feel like actually science fiction, but this actually had some like hard sci-fi elements to it. So that as well is good. So yeah, I'm 10 out of 10 on this, baby.
All right, Doug, you requested to go last. What do you got?
I mean, with everything that I know that's coming up, I can't. 10 out of 10 is a bold score.
Yeah, it is.
Don't agree with it. That to me is not an impossible score to achieve, but I'm leaning more towards Baker's side. Like, some of the themes in this were not pleasant. And I get that they're not supposed to be. They're supposed to make us see the evil side of the Empire. You know, you're supposed to really understand the heart and the root of the rebellion and why people want to rise up against the Empire. I get all of that, but honestly, it kind of felt like positioning the pieces. Like, yes, there was some dark themes in here. There were some spots where it was intriguing to see the characters in, you know, whatever new environment. But ultimately, it all felt a little bit like the dinner party with Mon Mothma. Just, okay, that's a thing that happened. I'm sure that'll be significant later. But to be honest, a little bit on the boring side. I'm not going to go... No, I'll say 6 out of 10 as well.
Okay. All right. That's it. It's been an hour. Jason, you want to sign us off?
Logic gate out.
It just every time, doesn't it?
It does every time. So,
I don't know about this outro thing. It's fine.
You started it. It's too late now.
I didn't.
You owned it.
You did. You got to own it.